pet food, and organic livestock feed. Propane exchange and filling, too. Located just past the Shell station on Kolo Road in Kilauea. Monday through Friday from 7:30 to 5:30 and Saturday from 8 to 1. Locally owned Kilauea Paint and Feed Store. 828-6655.
Lewis and Eddie Soltran Construction, 639-4836, building quality on Kauai for over 25 years. New custom homes, remodeling, and repairs. Exclusive dealer for Talia's Hurricane Roll-Down Shutters Protection for your home. Lewis and Eddie Soltran Construction, 639-4836, or SoltranConstruction.com.
And mahalo for listening to Kauai Soapbox. So today we're going to have a really, really good show. We've got some great scientists in here with us. We have Dr. Stephanie Seneff and Dr. Judy Carman. We might even hear in from Dr. Lauren Pang. But today we're going to talk about a lot of different topics and with strategies. And so in the front half of the hour, in this first half hour, I'm going to cover a number of the events that's been happening in our state mostly. And then we will focus in on what's going on with these people's research, both in glyphosate and then the impact of eating GMO food and feed with hogs. So when I've been looking at what's been going on this week, there's a mantra in this state or islands that says go along to get along, and that's being good, easy team players. But you know, we can also wake up, wise up, and rise up, because increasingly our governance is an example of compromised authority where the big sources of money set the rules at the expense sometimes of life itself. So you know, we need to turn our direction around, which is difficult, but happening as more whistleblowers are speaking out, more activists are rising up, they recognize the crisis is here. And both of our scientists today are people who are working in that direction. We're going to be taking calls later in the show. In the first portion, we're going to let them speak, and we're going to hear what each of them has to share, and in within their windows of time, people can call in when they're ready to be fielding questions. And then later on in the show, we will have, you know, regular, more full call in about other topics. So one question I ask is, why is change so slow? Our economy is showing that the dollars come from exploitation of both nature and people. And sometimes most comfortable people want the dollar tapped, not to get turned off. So it's hard to learn about environment and ethical problems because it requires each of us to change. And so it can be difficult listening to some of these things that are challenging. But the good news is people with the courage for positive change are rising up. And I think the key challenge is to stay smiling as we grow in awareness, but I'm happy to experience that it is very possible to do that. So some of the burning topics that have confronted us, we've had a big issue with housing, which we discussed last week, and climate change is another topic that is of high concern, and we're going to be having more about that on future shows, but I do want to say that there will be a panel discussion on July 29th at Niamalu Canoe Club. Looks like a great group of people are going to come and talk about that. So we'll have more of that coming up on another show, but just be aware that the state, the county, and some different citizens are going to be putting together a discussion to look at how things seemingly are impacting Kauai and, you know, what we can be expecting. Then both Judy and Stephanie, the doctors that are here, they are coming in about 2 weeks. Is that right, Stephanie?
End of July.
Okay, come near the... Okay.
Am I on?
Well, let's see.
One.
Okay, there you go.
Hi.
There.
Aloha.
Yeah.
End of July, yeah.
End of July.
28th, 9:30.
Yeah, so we'll be talking quite a bit about that a little bit later. So the 28th, the 29th, and the 30th in three different locations. I believe it goes Waimea on the 28th, Princeville on Wednesday the 29th, and then at the Performing Arts Center at KCC in Lihue on the 30th. And Dr. Lauren Pang will be joining you there. I will say that Dr. Lauren Pang is the one person that when he spoke, my mind finally opened up to considering that GMOs, there's something actually really of merit in looking with concern at that topic. Because prior to that, I actually didn't catch my attention yet. I'd heard it, but I hadn't really been able to put it together that that was truly a problem. Another element that's here is the beach and mountain access issues. So we have these old government roads that are quietly being lost. Tomorrow at the county council meeting, the Kekaha roads, I think, might be under discussion. I at least see that it is in the meeting minutes that are coming up before the group. So, and then the big topic has been the environmental and cultural devastation that has been underway with the Mauna Kea protectors. That has been a very, very big issue. And I did actually go to this Board of Land and Natural Resources meeting on Oahu last Friday. It was 7 hours of testimony, many of it which was very, very good, just powerful testimony. And I want to give a real shout out to the protectors who are up there. They're being called protesters. You can look at it either way. I am very clearly owning my bias that I support these people as an example of the human spirit. This today, I believe, is the 110th day of the vigil on the mountain of the Big Island of Hawaii. They have been up there for, you know, more than 3 months, approaching 4 months at 9,000 plus feet. Now with the water and the bathrooms turned off, it's a very big deal. And we saw last Friday at the Board of Land and Natural Resources, they implemented a set of emergency rules. And these rules are specifically designed to criminalize the set of people who are standing vigil to protect their mountain from, this is now the 14th telescope. And it's interesting to see because, like, would they do something like this on Mount Fuji? You know, I don't think so.
No, it's revered by too many people.
It's revered by too many people, and the Japanese are part of it. There's a lot of people that are in there doing it, and then none of this is really about the science. Even like I want to give a shout out to Pluto. There is been some pretty cool pictures out there. The New Horizon made it to Pluto, I guess, 72 seconds early on its planned 10-year journey. That's a pretty big darn yay. And even the people who are up there, they're not so much upset about science. It's about the impact of science and, you know, not including people in on the discussion and the time. And so with these rules that they've passed, the new consequences are $1,000 on the first event, second occurrence, $2,000, and then jail time for the third. So the crime that they have created is possession of a blanket or a tent or a backpack. They're limiting it to narrowing the hours of being allowed on the mountain. But something that's really concerning to me when I watch this is that emergency rules are intended for crises like having a lava flow into towns or fuel spills or when dam breaks.
And now they're creating a crisis, actually. They're just about creating a humanitarian crisis.
They're just about creating a humanitarian crisis. That's right. Because these people basically are exercising their First Amendment rights to freedom of speech, religion, the ability to assemble. And if they don't assemble 24/7, they'll desecrate the mountain. And these rules, they have 120 days time of implementation, but 120 days is enough time to go in there and take out that 8 acres worth of foundation that they're going to be putting underneath, it's very significant.
Do you mean that the construction was supposed to have been delayed for 120 days, but it's starting anyway? Is that it?
No, it's that this emergency set of rules is in place for 120 days. Like when we recently saw lava coming down at Pahoa, or when we see floods that take out roads, emergency sets of rules get put in place, but they have a natural sundown unless they're extended. So 120 days is typically that amount. And so what happens if they keep people from standing and blocking it, 120 days is enough time to really do the core damage that they were trying to not have happen. And it also covers over this time. They're going to have an international conference for astronomers here in Oahu, so I think they want to be able to say, hey, we've got these guys contained. But the Star Advertiser today, you know, had Governor Ige announcing that he is prepared to send the National Guard after the protectors, so that's tough. You know, it's the armed forces. I mean, people have been going in there armed, but I've been up there on the mountain, and the rangers and actually the DOCARE people, the enforcers for the Department of Land and Natural Resources, you can see there's a lot of respect for the people who are up there holding vigil, really, I would say, revitalizing the culture. There's so much learning. There's so many generations up there. They're actually creating a lot of new songs. A lot of really good things are happening. And what's hard to watch is how, you know, these conflicts of interest just don't have any kind of pushback. Like our state attorney general, who is the law arm behind this action, that says we can create emergencies, we can create laws that criminalize things that are basic human actions like keeping warm. But this state attorney general, Doug Chin, was most recently, you know, the head of law firm Carl Smith Ball, and they represent the University of Hawaii and the 30-meter telescope.
Right.
So their law firm is now the attorney general for the state that says, okay, we're not going to allow this. And, you know, he doesn't have to give a disclaimer, you know, and his testimony consumed about an hour of time at this meeting that was for the public to be able to state their case.
But it's still being challenged in the courts, right?
It's being challenged in the courts, and then there are new legal actions that are going to take place based on what happened on Friday. But in these type of cases, they don't stop the action when citizens are putting these cases forward. Seemingly, when the companies stop the actions, like what we saw on Kauai, Maui, and Hawaii, you know, they don't side with the people and let their law sit until it goes to court. So there's a definite bias. And so, you know, what's tough is that, you know, he's taking the lead at creating a crime definition to arrest these young activists, many of whom are teachers. They're operating in loving, peaceful resistance of Kapu Aloha, to me, in the fashion of a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi. I feel like history is happening now, and the state of Hawaii is standing in the wrong side of that history.
Right.
So there was another one, too. Board member Stanley Roerig, he's from Hilo. He has his own conflicts of interest, and he was aggressive and interrupting the testifiers as they spoke. He's a lawyer, and he has a 501c3 that it's not real evident what it does, but there's an organization called Trust that is the main funder of that 501c3. He is the one director. I didn't see any other kind of board there. And then Trust is funded by the 30-meter telescope. So his 501c3, funded by Trust, he's on the board, and he doesn't recuse himself. Now, I'm sure the 30-meter telescope is happy to do science and technology education, but, you know, engineering and math, it's like a STEM elements, I'm sure, come out of this. But there's no speaking and holding accountable that this is what happens. So we are seeing activist courts at all levels setting policy, you know, where when it really belongs in legislation. Last week you brought one up that I actually am kind of stoked about. Like, I honestly support marriage equality. I feel not threatened at all if two people who love each other are able to make a lifetime commitment. But really, I read the dissenting opinion on that, and it was a pretty, I think, well-crafted dissenting opinion by Justice John Roberts, which is saying, how can five people basically make a policy decision like that that supersedes what really the legislation should say? And, like, another area where I would disagree with what the activist court came up with is Citizens United, which is that says corporations are people and their freedom of expression could be expressed through unlimited electoral campaign spending.
And is there still an effort underway to initiate a constitutional convention to make a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United?
Yes, that is something that's definitely underway, and our county is on board with that. Our state didn't make that decision yet, but many states are. So there's a lot that's in transition. But we have to be careful what comes up. You know, we were speaking of the pesticide decisions, and to me, those strengthen and affirm the concentration of power. Basically, what they're saying is it's up to the state to decide whether these pesticides can be utilized. And in the case of Kauai, where we had our Ordinance 2491, which is disclosure, saying they need to tell us what's being sprayed and don't spray next to houses and schools and hospitals. Or really, mostly hospitals and schools. I don't know that it was that much against the houses. But when that was brought to the state legislature, in both the House and in the Senate, one individual in each of those branches of our legislature was able to simply never put it on the agenda for the next round of what we had going on there. So it didn't even get to be decided. So we are told, the science says, that these pesticides are safe. Probably many of our listeners feel that these pesticides are safe. As long as we follow the label, there will be no problem. And that the standards are set and the science is funded by the industry itself. That's what I see. We look at who is the head of the Food and Drug Administration and the EPA. Dr. Seneff, are you following that? You must be. Who with what happens at the national level?
I know. Yeah, Monsanto is very in deep with government, including the head of the FDA.
Yeah, so we're seeing that. So in the studio with me is Dr. Stephanie Seneff, who is a senior research scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. And I see articles all the time, some people really comfortable, some people struggling a little bit with your perspective. So we could say your research is controversial, but I see where it really flows with a corollary there. And can you give us a brief explanation of what your research is and who funds it, since, you know, I'm calling into question that for the other scientists?
Thank you. Yes. My research is on toxic chemicals in the environment, and I really began this journey 8 years ago when I was concerned about the autism rates in this country, which were going up exponentially at that time, and they're still going up since then exponentially, which is very alarming because that will eventually reach to half the children born in 2032. Being diagnosed with autism if we simply stay the course, and we are staying the course. So this is what has me greatly concerned. So what I'm doing is I wanted to find out what chemicals in the environment could be causative. And I went through everything I could find, and it wasn't until 5 years of looking that I found my answer. And I'm quite confident that I'm right. And I think although lots of things can cause autism, the thing that's causing the epidemic is a surprise. It's glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in the pervasive herbicide Roundup, which is everywhere, and in the food, in the water. And when you study that chemical, as I've done, you see that it explains autism. Its effects on biology explain the observed features of autism. So that's been my research.
And Dr. Lauren Pang is going to be coming for at least one of these days. And he, you're a scientist, so I want to have you help explain that more. But he uses a word that means in combination. When they're, do you remember that word? That
yes. Well, they're synergistically toxic.
But he's got some phrase that he uses when it means that you have several different chemicals or different toxins that are bouncing on top of each other that come together in combination. Do you know that word?
I would have guessed synergy, but I guess that's not the word you're thinking of. Synergistically toxic. That in combination, they're much more toxic than they are individually. Each one is more toxic because of the presence of the other one. And that's a very good example with glyphosate, actually, because the extra ingredients that they put into the formulation makes the glyphosate at least 100 times more toxic than it would otherwise be. And they're not required to study it in that context, and they're not required to study the other ingredients. So they're putting other toxic chemicals into the mix that have not been evaluated and that are making the active ingredient more toxic. And this is true pretty much for all of the herbicides.
And then when we have things like vaccines on top of the toxins or, you know, all different kinds of illnesses or underlying causes, it creates a greater vulnerability.
Absolutely. I mean, the vaccines become more, children become more vulnerable to the toxic chemicals in the vaccines as a consequence of their exposure to glyphosate and, of course, to all the other chemicals. We have so many chemicals today that we didn't have 100 years ago, which makes it a daunting task to figure out which ones might be contributing. But I feel very lucky to have stumbled upon glyphosate.
So you weren't looking for it.
Because I heard a talk, and it may be similar to you. You said that Dr. Pang caused you to finally see the issues with GMO. And for me, I wasn't thinking of glyphosate because I believed what we were told, that it's harmless to humans. It's a great herbicide for that reason. It's open. You don't have to, get registered. You just buy it at the hardware store. You can use it on your weeds in your yard. I mean, if it's that safe, how could it be the cause of autism? I mean, so I didn't even look at it. And many people have fallen into that trap. And the government's not looking at it either. So even when there is an event where there's a bunch of kids getting born with defects, they don't even think to look at glyphosate, even though it's probably the thing that's causing those defects in some cases. So it's being overlooked because we've become complacent with the idea that it's safe.
And let's make sure that I'm connected here. Dr. Judy Carman, are you there?
I am indeed.
Okay, great. And tell us where you're calling from. Or you're connected from?
From a city called Adelaide in the state of South Australia, in Australia, on the other side of the world.
Okay, so can you tell the listeners in Kauai a little bit of your background and what your research is? We're going to go deeper into it in a moment, but and who funds your research?
Okay, so my background, I've got a varied background. I've got a degree in science, then I've got an honours degree in organic chemistry, which is a research degree here that we have in Australia, as well as having a PhD in medicine in the field of nutritional biochemistry and metabolic regulation, and a Master of Public Health, so I specialise in epidemiology and biostatistics as well. I've taught at an agricultural college. I've taught in a research body that's a combined government and industry research body. I was also the senior epidemiologist in my state government investigating outbreaks of disease, and I've had senior positions in universities. So I come with quite a varied background, and I bring all of that into the research that I do on GM crops.
And who funds your work? Because I just had basically called into question the research of some of those that say it's safe, noticing that industry tends to fund their research. Who funds your research?
Well, I became a self-funded retiree back a while ago so that I could do this research. So I personally am largely not funded. Mm-hmm. Most of the funding for the research that we've done has actually come from the government of Western Australia when it was trying to decide whether it would lift its moratorium against growing GM crops or not. So it was a personal decision, I gather, from the Minister for Agriculture and Food in the government of Western Australia.
And so what was their decision? Did they lift it?
Well, that government there, in Australia, we've got a more left-leaning government and a more right-leaning government, as you do in the United States. You have Democrats and Republicans. In Australia, we have the Labor Party and we have the Liberal National Coalition. And the Labor Party decided to maintain the moratorium, but they lost the election. So the other party came in, the more right-leaning party came in, and they dropped the moratorium. So there is currently GM canola being grown in the state of Western Australia. However, the next election is a couple of years away, and it looks as though it's going to be there is still a policy difference between the two different parties, and the Labor Party has said that if it gets into power again, it will reimpose the moratorium.
Okay, so that's a really good synopsis for us. Why are the two of you, along with Dr. Lauren Pang, working together to create this panel discussion in Hawaii? What's causing this to come together?
Well, I was invited by people in the community in Hawaii to come over and give a talk to people to describe my research and what I've been doing, what I found out. And so that's my understanding of what's going on. So I look forward to coming to Hawaii to become better acquainted with the situation in Hawaii.
Well, you are very welcome here. Let me tell the listener, because we have listeners not just on Kauai, but around the island. So Maui, you guys will be there Wednesday, July 22nd in Kahului at 7 p.m. at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. And Thursday and Friday, the 23rd and the 24th, that is still up for discussion on exactly where it will be, but people can, you know, be observing and looking for that. The Maui contact is Christina. Her number is 283-0231. Then on the island of Hawaii, July 25th, you will be in Waimea from 1:30 to 5. That's at Tutu's house. And then on Sunday, July 26th, you'll be in Honoka'a from 6 to 9 p.m., and that's at the North Hawaii Educational Research Center. On Monday, July 27th, you'll be in Kona from 6 to 9. That's at the County of Hawaii Civic Center. And then on Kauai, July 28th at Waimea Canyon Middle School Cafeteria, 6:30 p.m. Wednesday, July 29th. The North Shore at 7 p.m. at the Church of Pacific in Princeville. On Thursday, July 30th in Lihue at 7 p.m., that's at the Kauai Community College Performing Arts Center. So, and I believe that's the one that Lauren Pang is going to be with you. I don't think he's going to be at every one of these, probably at Maui, because he works with the Department of Health in Maui, lives on Maui. Then on Oahu, Friday, July 31st, you'll be in Honolulu from 7 to 9 p.m. at the University of Hawaii Manoa Campus at the Art Auditorium. Saturday, August 1st, Honolulu, 3 to 5 p.m. at the, Hawaii Toho no Hikari Center. So that's 3 to 5. So we thank you both for coming to Kauai to really be speaking on this. And you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. This is Felicia with Kauai Soapbox. I have Dr. Stephanie Seneff and Dr. Judy Carmen in the studio with me. So can I call you Judy?
Absolutely, please do. We're very informal in Australia.
Okay, so Judy, my understanding, I looked at the website that is affiliated with you. Your work is mostly with hogs and doing feeding them with GMO and then non-GMO feed. Is that correct?
Yes. First of all, I think you're probably referring to the gmojudycarmen.org website. That's actually a fan site. It's run by people who like the work that I do and the papers that I write up there, and also there are good rebuttals to any attack from the industry and pro-GM people who don't like the work that I do and try and dismiss the work that I do. But yes, before we even get to hogs, the work that I've done, I've been in this area for well over a decade, and I first of all started looking at the sort of regulatory system that we have in Australia and New Zealand, because we've got a food regulator that covers two countries, Australia and New Zealand. And I started to look at the regulatory system there and to review the safety assessments that GM crop companies do in order to try and convince the government that their product is safe. So I've actually written already about the sort of safety assessments that are currently done by GM crop companies and sort of pulled them apart. And as part of the talk that I'll be giving, I actually do a review of quite a few of those safety assessments and just show how bad they are, just how weak the safety assessment process is in Australia and New Zealand, and where some of the best in the world, the regulatory system in the United States is far worse. And then because of the work that I've done there, I could see what hasn't been done and decided to do some research to, you know, what the way it should be done, to see what results you would get if you did do a study properly. And so I collaborated with very good people in the United States, and we did a hog feeding study in the United States. And we found quite a few things there.
So what did you find?
Well, when you do it properly, I mean, one of the problems with the way that the industry does their feeding studies is that they tend not to, if they actually do a feeding study on a GM crop, because quite a lot of them don't have a proper animal feeding study done where you're actually looking for endpoints that are relevant to human health. A lot of the feeding studies the industry does are actually there as animal production studies. So they're interested in, does the animal live or die? Does it produce meat? You know, has it got a good breast meat yield if it's fed to chickens? That kind of thing. So we actually did one where we were looking for toxicological endpoints. So the other thing that the industry does not do is they tend not to feed it to animals for a very long period of time. So therefore, things that take a while to develop, you can't find because they haven't had time enough to develop. So we fed these feeds to animals for their entire lifespan, their entire commercial lifespan, which is about 22.7 weeks. We also fed it to them from weaning, from the time they were weaned, which means that in effect they're fed while they're babies, they're fed while they're young, they're fed during their adolescence, and they're fed through their adulthood until they go, they're slaughtered in an abattoir in an ordinary slaughterhouse. So they were fed for over 5 months. We also had a nice sample size. We had 168 pigs. Often in the industry studies, they got very few animals, and therefore it becomes very difficult to find statistical significance, even if you've got very good biological significance happening. So, for example, if you've only got 20 animals in a group, 20 animals fed GM, 20 animals fed non-GM, then a quarter of the animals have got to die before you can find a difference in death rates. That's how bad the studies are. So with a nice sample size, you can actually find a difference in actually find a difference. So what we found, and there were, we went in there with some hypotheses we wanted to test, and that was as a result of what farmers had been seeing in their animals in the United States. Given that most of the GM crops that are on the market are actually crops that go into animal feed, and they go into animal feed in a fairly large amount, it's clear that the first place you should really look for adverse effects would actually be in farm animals. They've been fed now for decades. They've been fed, well, at least a decade, and they've been fed crops in fairly large amounts in their diet on a daily basis. So the word that was coming through from farmers in the United States is that there were problems that were starting to develop in their animals. In particular, there were reproductive problems and there were digestive system problems, particularly along the lines of inflammation that was happening in the gut of these animals. So we went in there trying to particularly determine if there were problems there. We fed the diet. We also fed a mixed diet because the animals, the safety assessments that are done on these crops are only done on a GM crops that contain one genetically modified protein, that are designed to produce one genetically modified protein at once. And the only problem with that is that most of the crops, most of the corn in the United States is genetically engineered to contain more than one. So the most common GM crop planted, my understanding, is a triple stack. So you've actually got three GM crops in there at the same time, three GM genes in there at the same time.
So can you give us an example of what those three genes are intended to do?
Yes, the two major ones in GM crops, because if you listen to what the industry says about GM crops, they say, oh, we're going to feed the world with it, you know, we're going to increase yield and all the rest of it. In fact, the two main types of genes that go into a GM crop are, first of all, a gene that makes the plant resistant to a herbicide being sprayed upon it. And the most common ones of these are actually, so they're made resistant so that you can spray the crop with Roundup, with glyphosate, which is in Roundup. You can spray it with a glyphosate-containing herbicide. The crop lives and the weeds around it die. And, of course, that means that you can end up with higher residues of glyphosate, not only in the soil but also in the crop. And the other major class is where they try and reduce the amount of insecticide sprayed on the crop, because they get the plant to produce its own. So the plant produces an insecticide so that when a particular grub comes along and tries to eat the plant, the proteins, the GM protein that's made in that plant, gets eaten by the grub, goes into the stomach of the grub, causes pores to form in the intestines of the grub, and the grub, basically, the gut ruptures and the grub dies. The gut ruptures, the gut dies. So the plants that we were feeding, the crops that we were feeding to these pigs, contained three GM genes, and there were two of these insecticidal genes called BT genes, and one herbicide-tolerant gene, which is the Roundup Ready gene. And we fed these two pigs, and which is what pigs generally in the United States eat. It is very common for them to eat GM crops, very common for them to eat these three GM genes at once in these crops. So we had one group of pigs where they were fed that mixed diet, and another group of pigs that were not. They were fed a diet that didn't have any GM genes in there. We followed them for the commercial lifespan of the pigs, as I said. We measured lots of things on the way, such as, you know, body weights and if they were getting sick more often and all that sort of stuff. And then they went to the abattoir. They were weighed at the abattoir. They went through the abattoir.
An abattoir is where they're killed, is that right? An abattoir is the slaughterhouse?
Yes, that's right. So we call it an abattoir. I think you call it a slaughterhouse. So they went to the slaughterhouse, a commercial slaughterhouse, as a commercial pig does. And it was slaughtered, and we got the entrails. We got the stomach, the intestines, the kidneys, the liver, that sort of thing. We got those, and then veterinarians had a look inside those to see what was going wrong with them. Now, so the organs were weighed, the veterinarians sliced open certain organs and had a really good look inside. Now, the veterinarians were blinded, which means that when they were holding, for example, the stomach of a pig in their hand, that pig had a number. The veterinarian did not know whether that pig was fed GM or not. So all of their observations were completely unbiased. We got the results, analyzed them, and we found two major things that were of concern. The first one is that, remember I was talking about possible reproductive problems in pigs?
Yes.
We found that the female pigs had an increase in the size of the uterus of 25% on average, 25% higher, and this was highly statistically significant. Now, we couldn't look at the reproductive system of males because in commercial piggeries, the males have their testicles cut off at 3 days of age. Because a male pig with testicles is likely to produce something called boar taint in the meat. So the meat gets a bit of a taint to it, which is not consumers don't like to eat. So male pigs have their testicles cut off at 3 days of age, so we couldn't have a look in their testicles. But there was this very strong finding in amongst the female pigs that the weight of the uterus was 25% higher.
And so remember the other thing? Bigger. The uterus is bigger.
It's heavier.
Heavier.
Heavier, yeah. So it's 25% heavier. Now, whether that means that it's 25% bigger or whether it means that there's something else going on in the uterus, such as maybe it's thicker, maybe it's inflamed, maybe, you know, other things are happening, all of those things are possibilities. And there are a number of medical conditions that this could be related to, all of which have rather long names and all of which you wouldn't want to have. But the other thing that we found was that the, remember I talked about farmers observing this sort of an increase in inflammation occurring in the gastrointestinal tract. Well, we couldn't actually have a look in the large intestine or the small intestine because I think pigs are huge, and they've got huge intestines, and they were full of digester still. So we couldn't actually open up the small and large intestine, flush out all the contents, and have a really good look inside. The only thing that we could look at easily was the stomach of the pigs. And the veterinarians sliced those open along the big curve of the stomach, washed them out, and had a really good look inside. And they measured, you know, whether there was an increase in ulcers or whether there was an increase in inflammation. And what we found is that in American piggeries, there tend to be a little bit of inflammation happening in the stomachs because of the type of diet that the pigs have. It's a very, very finely ground diet. But feeding GM took this very low level of inflammation and boosted it right up to severe. So if you looked at the number of pigs, the proportion of pigs that had this severe stomach inflammation, it was dramatically raised in the pigs fed the GM feed. Now, when I say severe inflammation, what I mean is that the stomach, when you look at it, instead of being kind of like a beige brown color, is bright red. It's sort of bright cherry red or bright sort of fire engine red. In the stomach, across basically all of the stomach, and it's also the stomach's also swollen.
I want to confirm that there's pictures on the website that are showing that.
Yes, and the pictures on the website are good. I'm not sure if they've got, they certainly is, it's a picture of a non-inflamed stomach and a severely inflamed stomach, I think, on the website. And yes, you can see what I mean by severely inflamed. I look at that and go, ooh, I would not want that. I would not want that kind of stomach.
And in humans, there is an occurrence of leaky gut is one thing that's called, and GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disorder. Do you call those things that in Australia? Is that something that you're seeing down there? That human problem, it sounds like it might have a corollary.
Well, the other human problem that may have a corollary is a inflammatory bowel disease.
Okay.
So the two main forms of inflammatory bowel disease are ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. They have increased in the United States over the last few years. Now, obviously, there needs to be an investigation to determine whether there's a link between eating GM crops and not. But they have increased after GM crops were introduced into the United States. And these are nasty diseases. These are, the only cure for ulcerative colitis is to have your large bowel cut out. And Crohn's disease, you can never really cure that. Really nasty, awful diseases that you wouldn't want to have. Now, I'm not suggesting that GM crops have increased, say, ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. We don't know that for sure. But there does seem to be, at least in the stomach, an increase in some sort of inflammation that's occurring in the stomachs. It's quite clear, quite graphically clear. And this sort of raise of inflammation was, overall, if you join the males and females together, over twice as likely to happen in pigs that were fed the GM diet. In the females, it was over twice as high. But in the males, it was four times higher chance of having this severe stomach inflammation if you were fed the GM diet.
And you're listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea.
Alert from Lodge in Wingao. Are you sure you want to quit all the applications and log
this
right
is
now?
Felicia, and we are listening to Dr. Judy Carman calling in from Australia. So, Judy, are you... we might have just lost her. We will bring
no,
her...
No, I'm here.
Okay, there you are. All right.
Yes, ma'am.
There was something that came in on that. All right, so continue.
Yes, so that they were our findings. Yes.
So it's very powerful. Are you willing to take a call from a listener? Is this a good time, or do you have more core pieces to be sharing?
Well, they're the kind of main things. I can certainly talk more about the sort of safety assessments that GM crop companies do and how woeful they are. I think we could come back to that. I'm more than happy to take a call from a viewer.
Okay. If a caller has a question specific to Dr. Judy, 826-7771. And Judy, do you know Dr. Bob Streit? He came here.
I do.
He had some really interesting stories on pigs in the huggeries in Iowa.
Yes, and that's where we did this research, was actually in Iowa. And I've met Bob, and he's a fantastic man, a really, really good man. And it was because of observations like that that we did this research. And let me also say about the observations that people like Bob are making. In infectious disease outbreaks, what we would find is that we'd often get sort of like a red flag going up. We'd get somebody calling in saying, oh, I went to a wedding and there were 100 people there and 90 people are ill. At that point, we would feel obliged to investigate. You know, we would then contact the people who'd organised the wedding, we would contact the facility, we would contact everyone that was there, and we'd work out how many people were ill and what they were ill with. Now, when people like Bob stand up and say, look, this is what we're seeing in pigs or cattle or whatever it is in Iowa, where we've been feeding these animals for a long period of time and we're now seeing these issues, then that's the equivalent of somebody phoning up saying, I went to a wedding and 100 people are sick. We need to really do an investigation. It's not the sort of stuff that you should sweep under the carpet.
Go ahead.
And so when I was told about the situation that was happening in Iowa, you know, by people on the ground, by people like Howard Vlieger, who was the person that I did this research with in Iowa, that's when you've got an hypothesis to test, and that's when you should be doing these sorts of studies, such as we did on these pigs, to actually go in and see if there's good, hard scientific evidence for those anecdotal findings. Because a lot of people will dismiss what farmers are saying, going, oh, well, that's just anecdotal. No, you don't dismiss it. You actually go in and you should go in and investigate.
What Bob shared at a talk that I went to is seeing a fertility collapse, that there was a whole lot less fertility, and at one point he had been a hog farmer himself, and his hogs, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, had a fertility issue to where it was impacting his ability to do that. And he was a consultant that would go around and do hog feed, and he at one point was a regular user of the GMO feeds. And then when he started to see that corollary between that and the infertility, he said that the hog industry was in trouble in Iowa. Am I remembering correctly? Is that consistent with what you have learned from him?
Yes, and not only from him, but from other people in Iowa as well. And that was one of the reasons why we did this study in hogs, or pigs as we call them in the US, in Australia. Basically, the things that my understanding that have been seen is that in female pigs, sows, there's a reduced ability to conceive and higher rates of miscarriage. And in boars, there was a reduction. If a boar was actually used on a sow to get a pregnancy, because these days that tends not to happen. See, these days there's a lot of artificial insemination occurring, and that may be overlaying and hiding sort of other aspects of infertility that might actually be occurring. Because when you buy a straw with semen in it, you're buying a certain number of viable sperm. Whereas if the boar was used directly on the sow, you might find more problems there because you can't guarantee the quality of the semen that you're using, you see. And if boars are actually used on sows, because there are some people in the United States, particularly amongst the sort of Mennonite sort of communities, the sort of religious communities where boars are still used, they found that there's a reduction in the number of piglets born, and that's also a problem. But the other thing with artificial insemination that might be covering over some real problems that could be, it's not like some bigger problems that could really be happening in the US piggery industry, is that not only when you use artificial insemination are you guaranteed a certain number of viable sperm, but they tend to come from sort of super boars, if you know what I mean. Like they get good quality sperm from really top grade boars. So the genetics of the pigs have improved over time at the same time that GM feed has been coming into the United States piggery industry. So therefore, the problems that are being seen in the US piggery industry could have been far worse, in my view, if the artificial insemination hadn't been brought in.
Right. And, you know, I did read another study, and we did a little bit of a feature on human teenage improvements on unwanted pregnancies or early fertility in kids or early childbearing. And they say, sex education must be working because we've had a 30% drop in unwanted teen pregnancies. And there was an OB who was saying, well, you know, we've got a whole lot higher rate of infertility in the 20-something set. And it was being hypothesized that maybe there's infertility in the teenagers. And that's why that there's actually being a lower amount of unintended pregnancies in this age group.
Yes, you could be very much right about that. And I think that's another one of the things that says, okay, we need to do an investigation. Because I would say to you that getting sort of sex education classes in classrooms is fantastic and should, in theory, reduce the rate of teenage pregnancies. However, if a system has reduced it by 30%, then that is remarkably good. Impressively good, like far better than any other sex education system that's ever been invented, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the outcomes of this marvellous sex education system are a little bit too high to be able to be sheeted back to sex education systems.
And Dr. Seneff is in here. Stephanie, do you have any questions for Judy?
Yes, I would have a question. Judy, I'm wondering about failure to thrive, because I've heard that among the pigs in America there's something on the order of a 20% failure to thrive among the piglets once they're weaned, once they're put on the GMO Roundup Ready feed. Do you know about that?
Yes. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you? Aloha.
Aloha. Yes, I have to learn a whole new series of words. Aloha. It's great that you've got Stephanie on the program, let me say. I will be, when I speak in Hawaii, I'll be speaking on the same stage as Stephanie. So thank you. Stephanie, it's my understanding, because you're a bit faint there in the background, that you're talking about a failure to thrive.
Yes.
In your piggeries, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Failure to thrive.
Yes. Now, there's something that's also been happening in US piggeries over this time, and that is that there is a new disease that has become apparent in piggeries. It's called PRRS, which is porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome. And it's like an underlying condition that started to develop in pigs that then makes them far more vulnerable to other diseases coming along, such as pneumonia. So and the pigs that we used in our study were PRRS positive pigs, because now it's spreading through the US herds, and now it's my understanding is that the majority of pigs in the United States actually have this syndrome or have been exposed to this syndrome. So what causes this is an interesting question. What role GM crops may play in this is also an interesting question. What role the additional spraying of herbicides on GM crops might be playing in this is also an interesting question. But there has been when a pig gets PRRS, there is often a failure to thrive, because not only may the condition itself cause problems in the pig, but the fact that then if a disease comes through the herd, that pig's more likely to get the disease and therefore be affected by it.
Mm.
So does that answer your question, Stephanie?
Yes, that's perfect. Thank you.
And you're listening to Community Radio. Marshall, do we have a traffic report coming in?
We do. A few people have called to report that the Kalihiwai Bridge is closed. There were sirens heard. It's hard to know exactly what's going on. It's backed up at least to Kilauea in that direction, and we don't know how far in the other direction. So no need to head across the Kalihiwai Bridge right now. You're not going anywhere.
And we'll pray that they're all safe. And I also have gotten in a report from Hawaii Island that Governor Ige did sign this set of rules criminalizing the people holding vigil up on the mountain, so that means there will possibly be action against them tomorrow. Thank you, Dr. Judy. Can you continue? Or Stephanie, do you have more questions for her?
I think that's it for now.
Okay, so Continue, Judy. What else have you been learning?
Well, one of the things that we've been doing is actually sort of reviewing the safety of GM crops, and we've been doing that for some time. So what I'd like to do is just sort of describe some of the things about GM crops and actually how they're kind of regulated by various countries around the world. And in order to do that, and also, you know, what a company does, what a GM company does in terms of safety assessments before it comes to a regulator, a food regulator, and says, look, here's what I've done. Here are my safety assessments. Please assess it to be safe so it can come into your food supply. And to do that, I went to the Australian Food Regulator because, you see, in Australia, it's a compulsory system. If a GM company wants to introduce a new GM crop into the Australian or New Zealand food supply, they've got to submit safety data to our regulator. Now, in the FDA, in America, that there's no requirement for that. You have a completely voluntary system over in the United States. Now, what companies have done in the United States is that they have volunteered to provide information to the FDA, but there's no requirement for that to happen. So in Australia, it's a good way of actually getting some understanding of what GM crop companies do in their safety assessments, because our food regulator here will then write a report of about 70 pages saying what was in the safety assessments. And if you have a look at that, there are a couple of things that actually stand out. There are four major, and so this is the only thing that gets done on a GM crop before it comes into the food supply. This is what I'm talking about. There may be other studies later on after it comes into the food supply, and independent researchers can get hold of it to a certain extent to do those things. But when it comes into the food supply, this is the only information available about that crop. There are four major concerns about these crops. The first one is that it might cause an allergic reaction in people. Well, there are no allergy studies done on animals or people before that crop comes into the human food supply. There's a theoretical one done whereby they artificially, kind of on a computer, chop up the protein that they expect that GM crop to produce into artificial little small bits, and then they compare those small bits to a database that they have of known allergens to see if there's any cross correlation.
Just at a data level.
Absolutely. Just at a data level. Yep. And so the problem there is that we don't know all the allergens in the world. Even in peanuts, we don't know all the allergens. And then this database only contains a few of those anyway, a subset of all known allergens. And then, as I've seen my food regulator say, even if there is some association, some similarity found between the protein they expect to find and known allergens such as seafood allergy, things that cause seafood allergy, they still often let them in. They still let them into the food supply.
So does your government do any better job than the American government at protecting the people?
In theory, yes, because there's this requirement to do a safety assessment and for the company to do a safety assessment and to provide data to my government regulator. But in reality, no, because my government regulator, like most regulators in the world, do not have their own laboratories. They rely upon information that the company chooses to give to them. And my government also has a policy of not reviewing the raw data that the government, that the company actually provides. So basically they're relying upon what the company not only does in research, but then what the company chooses to tell the government in what it's done in research, and then what it interprets its results to be on that research that it has chosen to do and report.
Well, thank you for sharing all this. It's at 5 o'clock at the top of the hour. What time is it there, Judy?
It's 12:30 in the afternoon.
It's pretty interesting for me. I've never heard of a half-hour time difference before, so I learned something new from you. So we're going to...
My state's a bit unusual.
Yeah, we're going to hear from the underwriters, and then I'm going to allow Stephanie to come in a little stronger with her research, and we'll be seeing you know, how she segues on what your experience is. But for now, you're listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea. This is Felicia and Marshall with Kauai Soapbox, and I have Dr. Stephanie Seneff and Judy Carmen on the air with us.
KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea K224CQ Anahola K284AL Haleiwa.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
The Copper Man. Copper, stainless steel, and galvanized aluminum. We specialize in ornamental and custom work and fabricate and install any kind sheet metal work, residential and commercial. Serving Kauai for over 30 years. We're still talking. HarryConti.com. That's HarryConti.com or 639-3456.
808 Equipment Rentals, providing tractor, bobcat, and BCS tiller services island-wide, including pasture mowing, garden bed raising, vegetation removal, terracing, gravel spreading, and more. 808 Equipment Rentals in Molawa'a. 823-1000.
So, mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio, and we really particularly appreciate our underwriters like the Copper Man and 808 Equipment Rental. This is a community station, and people sometimes pop in and join the dialogue. I actually have two wonderful people in here. So, Doug, do you have a quick question for either one of our scientists?
Right, for either one of you guys, you are the glyphosate experts, as I'm understanding. I'd like to hear both your opinions on the, if I'm saying the word correctly, the adjuvant.
Adjuvant, yes.
Which is, what I understand, 100 times more toxic than glyphosate itself.
Yes, some remarkable studies.
Can you tell me what adjuvant, or what is that?
Yes, well, so, and I had mentioned this earlier, that when they make the formulation, this is actually very shocking to me.
Say that word one more time.
Adjuvant, A-D-J-U-V-A-N-T.
So what's an adjuvant?
So when they make the formulation of the product, they put in the active ingredient, which in the case of Roundup is glyphosate, and then they put other stuff in there. And so the question is, what is that other stuff, and why is it there? And they've actually had, they have many, many patents. I've been rummaging through the patent literature that these companies have put out about different products that you can add to the mix to make the chemical more toxic to the plants. So the whole goal is to improve the performance of the herbicide in its ability to kill the weeds. And what's remarkable to me is that there's no need to, in terms of the regulatory process, there's no need to see if this modified product is any more toxic than the original glyphosate by itself, which is what they had studied in order to get the approval to put this product on the market. It is a huge problem.
So it's kind of like when you get different types of gas when you're at the pump, and some of them say, oh, they'll clean your engine better, and you see a little scrub brush bubble smiling at you or something like that. It's just
right.
Like...
Yes, but it's much better, and that's what he's saying. Even 1,000 times better. 1,000 times better in controlling the weeds, and 1,000 times more toxic to the human.
Is the adjuvant, again, I can't
adjuvant?
Pronounce it. Adjuvant?
Adjuvant.
Okay. Is that, as I understand it, that is what allows the glyphosate to be processed into the plant?
That's exactly right. These are like surfactants that they add. Like, there's something called POEA, and it has a very long, complicated chemical name.
Can you tell us what surfactant is?
So these are things that are going to, like, dissolve fats. It's like when you soap.
Okay.
And then, so what happens is when you add that, the cell has a fatty cell wall, and this soap opens up holes in that cell wall so that the glyphosate can get in. And it does it to us, too. I mean, we're not immune to that same process because our cell walls are also fatty.
So I have a question. When they spray these crops, and I understand other crops like wheat or different things are sometimes sprayed with this that aren't even designed for it, they call it a desiccant?
Yeah.
Defoliant, like when they're, like we used to, or they still do on Maui, burn sugar before it's harvested, get rid of the leaves. that they will spray different crops with this that aren't even genetically modified.
That is right, and I believe that's the source of our epidemic in celiac disease. I've written a paper together with Anthony Samson on that topic.
So celiac disease, that means when people have a problem with wheat, and we see gluten intolerance all over, but celiac disease is the name
same
for
thing.
Being
well, celiac disease is a more specific term, but people can have gluten intolerance without the celiac, but all of it, I think, is being caused by the spraying of the wheat with glyphosate just a few days before the harvest. And because the government thinks that this product is so safe, they don't even bother to test to see if the glyphosate's in the wheat.
I've seen people making comments, again, this would be anecdotal, but we see it on Facebook where they're saying, wow, I went to Europe and I'm eating the French bread and I'm eating the Italian pastas and blah, 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 and I'm not having the reaction that I typically do, even from gluten-free things here in the United States.
Yes, and in fact, I have gotten many email messages from people who have told me that anecdotally. I go to Europe, I can eat the wheat, I can eat the bread. I come back home, I can't. And we are really much more careless about the usage of these chemicals. And also, we're not testing any. We're not almost not testing at all.
And Judy, do you have anything to say about either that, the surfactants or the adjuvants, as I'm learning new words?
No, that's more Stephanie's field than mine. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I mean, it's a bit like deciding you're going to safety test a cookie and you're only going to safety test the flour. You're not going to test the butter or the sugar or the chocolate chips in it or anything else, you know. When you spray something like Roundup, you're spraying Roundup. You're not just spraying glyphosate. And it makes sense to me to safety test the Roundup rather than just the glyphosate. You know, you need to safety test the thing that is sprayed rather than just one component of it.
Thank you. And Stephanie, I would love it if you would just give the listener an overview of what you do, and I'm going to remind you that many people driving down the road don't
sitting
even...
Sitting on the road right now, sorry.
Pardon me?
Waiting
sitting
on the road right
sitting
now.
Sitting on the road, waiting for the...
Very bored.
The place to open up at Kalihiwai Bridge, but hoping that we have no fatalities there. So
yeah, really.
That's always the most important thing. So for the person who's sitting on the road listening and is a newbie to understanding this, these aren't doctorate students, tell us what you do.
Right. I mean, basically, I started 8 years ago, and I said this earlier, with autism. I really wanted to find out. I wanted to get to the bottom of what's causing all these cases of autism in this country, which I consider to be a serious crisis. And, of course, it's not just autism. We have many, many diseases that are going up alarmingly in the last 10 years in step with the increase in the use of glyphosate on corn and soy crops. So once I discovered glyphosate was a possibility, I heard a two-hour presentation by Professor Don Huber,
yes,
who's a retired professor from Purdue, a really fantastic man. And
he's been on this show.
I was blown away. That is fantastic, and I hope people got a chance to hear him because he's my hero. I mean, I heard that talk, and it changed my life. This was 3 years ago, and ever since then, I've been eating and drinking and sleeping glyphosate papers. I've just been reading everything I can on glyphosate.
So I want to back you up on that because when I hear people get nitpicky about what is your specific area of expertise, Dr. Don Huber worked for 40 years in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, right? He went through that many presidents, and his kuleana, his responsibility was what are imminent threats to United States well-being, the Department of Defense, what is a threat relative to agriculture? And he said glyphosate.
He did, yes, very, very squarely.
And he got let go for it. After 40 years, they went, oh, excuse me, professor from, Purdue and had been in the military,
yes,
really high ranking
very,
in
very
the Navy.
Prestigious credentials.
Prestigious credentials that shut him down,
yes,
for waving a red flag.
Right, and I should say, by the way, you asked me who my funding was, and I didn't answer that question earlier, and I should tell you that because it's interesting. I've been funded for many years by a computer company in Taiwan called Quanta Computers, and my work is in computer science, so I don't do any lab work with, you know, any kind of chemicals. I have a biology, biophysics background as an undergraduate at MIT, and then a degree in computer science, PhD.
And you're able to be looking at the corollaries, almost like the statistics. Marshall, we have an update?
the Kalihiwai Bridge is now open, traffic is moving freely, and there was an accident and no fatalities.
Yay, thank you. So, Stephanie, so thank you. Continue.
Yes, and so so fortunately this company has been very supportive of my research, and they are interested in medical issues and health issues, and they want me to study databases, health databases, and do statistical analyses and uncover health issues, and then to correlate that with the literature. When you see certain diseases that are going up, like diabetes and obesity, you can correlate that with other things in the environment, such as various toxic chemicals, and you can ask the question, well, which chemicals are also going up? If they match, then that's a candidate, just like smoking causes lung cancer. Eventually we figured that out.
Another corollary that would be simplistically stated, it doesn't rain, your grass turns brown, right?
Yes,
so
right.
So one could say, all right, you can't prove it,
right?
But there can be enough circumstantial evidence that you say, you know, every time it doesn't rain,
right,
the fields turn brown, and when
the
it
correlations
rains.
Are amazing with the glyphosate. And but more than that, I wouldn't be at all persuaded by correlation to say, oh yes, of course this is causal. But if you see correlation, the first thing you should do is to see if it might be causal. And you can do that by studying the research literature. So that's what I do. I have thousands of papers on my computer, and my computer analyzes those papers for me to get word-word correlations and to get sort of models of stories in biology that I can then look at the glyphosate toxicity and then look at the manifestations of health, for example, in autism or obesity. What is it? The underlying biology that's associated with that, and to see if they match.
And you're being careful. I know that, like, as we see almost an exponential curve just in population, we could see certain corollaries that might look like, okay, more people are eating organic food. But
right.
But your research is going far deeper than that. Can you give us some of the numbers? Like, I know for Dr. Huber, it was a very, very big issue on the autism numbers. It used to be something like 1
yes.
in 10,000 in maybe 1970. What year was
that's
that?
That's right. 1 in 10,000, 1970. Glyphosate was introduced in 1975. The growth has been exponential since then. Exponential growth is very, very scary, and you can simply very easy to model it, because if you take a log, you get a straight line. You just extend that line to find out where it's going to be in the future.
And
that's how I get my number for 2032.
And for people without a mathematical background, an exponential curve kind of looks like a hockey stick.
Yes, that's right.
It's been going flat, and all of a sudden it hits a point where
it really
goes
fast once it gets going. It is really scary. And it has been consistently exponential, even since 8 years ago when I first was aware that it was exponential. It continued to be exponential, perfect match to an exponential curve since then. So that's really, really scary to me. This means 80% of the boys, 2032, 80% of the boys born will end up on the autism spectrum if this continues.
And I think something that's very important to say relative to the autism spectrum is, I mean, maybe all of us are somewhat there. I mean, I'm probably a little ADHD or something. I don't know. I mean, everybody's got something.
Right.
But so there's a distance from profound to just being able to not focus, all of that, right?
Yes.
So we're seeing this trending in that way.
Yeah, and of course, ADHD is really huge. I mean, it's like 12% or something of the kids today. So many of them are on Ritalin. It's really disturbing to me. And that's another manifestation of these poisons. And we have obesity, you know, childhood obesity. We have all these allergies, asthma, eczema. I mean, eczema is huge right now. It's just amazing. It's like very common for kids to have eczema. We don't even think about it
and
anymore.
And eczema is associated with asthma and other things.
These are all allergic diseases, yes.
Yeah, and even something called angioedema, that, you know, these things that
yes.
are almost another big word, idiosyncratic. They don't even know what causes them.
Right, so many things are idiosyncratic, you know, and we're just getting used to the fact, oh, yeah, so half the kids, over half the kids in this country have one of these really pretty serious issues. It's shocking to me. And, you know, we have huge health care expenses in this country, way more than any other country. And it really shocks me when people say, oh, Americans have been eating GMOs for years and they don't have any problems. And I'm like, what planet are you on?
What
you know?
Planet are you on? And is it also our cell phones? Is it what's going
right.
on in Fukushima? We have so many challenges that are...
Yes.
are coming through. We have also really sharp listeners who are giving, I guess they're, you know, don't go over Kalihiwai Bridge if you can avoid it. Wait a little while. Somebody else is still backed up. So we are having some challenges there. Okay, so Alzheimer's is another one.
Yes, perfect match, by the way, with glyphosate usage on corn and soy crops. This is something, by the way, Nancy Swanson is the one who did this study, and it's an amazing paper that she's published with collaborators that has something like 30 or 40 figures in it, and shows all these diseases that are going up, and they're scary. I mean, of course, Alzheimer's, autism, Parkinson's, various cancers, thyroid cancer, pancreatic cancer, various gut disorders, inflammatory bowel disease, you know, of course, celiac, and kidney, massive kidney problems, kidney failure, kidney cancer, liver, hepatitis, so all these things are going up.
Kidney, that would be affiliated with diabetes, is that correct?
It is, that's right, and we have so many people on dialysis now, and that's very expensive, and of course, they get sick, too, on dialysis. You can't keep doing dialysis. Eventually, you'll completely corrode your bones. You know, it's not an easy thing to live with.
So you are seeing these corollaries, and then I know that you're getting a little bit of a backlash because you're challenging, right?
Yes, yes.
You're challenging.
Well, I think it's a matter of disbelief. I mean, I think people, myself included, there's a shock value when you say, oh, well, this Roundup that we buy and we kill our weeds in our yard, how can that be so toxic? Surely the government has protected us, and they have surely done their homework all these years. How could we have had this chemical poison, something this bad, in our environment all these years and not know it? And this is a question I would say, too. How can we have done that? And so it took me a while. I mean, at first, so Don gave his talk, and it matched my autism. I had all these problems I saw with autism, for example, inflammatory gut, leaky gut. And I couldn't explain. I thought, well, once they have the leaky gut, I can explain a lot of the rest of it in terms of how their brain gets affected by the leaky gut. But where is the leaky gut coming from? And I had a complete, I was stumped, you know. And then Don Huber totally explained it with the glyphosate, because it is a patented antimicrobial agent, and it's been shown to preferentially kill the beneficial bacteria in the gut, especially lactobacillus, which is crucial when the child is born. That's the first bacterium that gets hold. And that bacterium then controls whatever else happens. So it keeps the pathogens in check. But if you're killing the lactobacillus, that gives the pathogens a chance to grow. And that's how you get the inflammatory gut. And that causes
alert
a lot of the rest
in window.
Are you sure? So I don't know where that little sound is coming in, but thank you for sharing that observation. If I have any callers who would like to ask questions of either Judy or Stephanie, the number is 826-7771. So what about the other pesticides? You know, I mean, you're focused on that one, and then, you know, there's other ones that,
yes,
you know, are restricted-use pesticides that have...
That may be worse. I mean, people believe they're worse, certainly. Atrazine, 2,4-D, dicamba. What is really scary to me is that, you know, we've been using more and more glyphosate every year because of these glyphosate-resistant weeds that are showing up all around the glyphosate-resistant crops. And so they are finally admitting that they can't control these weeds anymore with just glyphosate.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they're getting approval to make a, you know, Enlist Duo.
Right, and 2,4-D, which is a major ingredient in...
Enlist Duo.
Yeah, and that's that. That was Agent Orange, and that has been tested here. We have a caller on the air. Thank you so much. You are on the air.
Aloha. I have a question for everyone, I suppose. Both of you lovely ladies, thank you so much for this information. I've really been wanting to... come to the talk coming up here, and I have a question. I know that we have so much Roundup being used on this golf course in Princeville, and I know that it's killing the reef, and I know it's hurting the people around here, living around the golf course and on the North Shore. And I also know, I used to work in a doctor's office, and I know about all of the heightened restrictions on people's privacy in the medical world, and so it's really hard to track people's health over a period of time. And I'm just wondering how we can get information about our, let's just say the North Shore, for instance. Like, how can we start to gather information legally as a layman And how can we get together and start putting two and two together as far as what are our health issues? Excuse me. I have a feeling that these are my theories just from my intuitive observations, but I think everyone's dealing with, you know, kidney issues, and I feel like people are dealing with slight autistic. I feel like almost all these children that are being born now are like from 1 to 100 autistic. I almost think that there's a 1% of autism that's just laying there in children that just, I have this sense that
Marshall,
there's like a there's a percentage, and Marshall, that this will only get worse and worse if we remain ignorant. And I know really innocent people, like you just said, are buying this stuff. And I remember a very conscious woman that was my mentor, a gardener back in Arizona, that said, "You want to get that mesquite, you got to put the Roundup on it." And I remember my boyfriend, who was a very avid non-toxic gardener, was like, "What is she doing?" And it seemed so, like people have blind spots. Like, you know what I mean? Like, people will be like, "I don't do A, B, and C, but then D's okay." But it's totally like when you look from the outside, it just seems ridiculous that they would allow for that.
So, caller, you have a lot of complex questions right there. Do you want to give a shot at any of that, Stephanie?
No, well, I think it is actually very difficult to get the medical data. And even for researchers, you know, you have to go through all these privacy issues, and the hospitals don't want to release data. And it's really very, very difficult in this country to get the medical data you need. And I know this because this is, you know, what I do.
And on Kauai, our Department of Health person for the state, his name is Dalit Beal, I believe. And I've tried to talk to him about it, and he's... You know, he kind of listens, but he doesn't respond. It's like testifying at the Board of Land and Natural Resources or something. But Dr. Lauren Pang is paying attention. He is with the Department of Health. He's with the Department of Health, and he's very much concerned on it. I know that the insurance companies, they actually hold all this information mm-hmm. by zip code.
Yes.
And so, you know, it is possible to get the information. The Department of Health has to have the political will to do it.
Yes.
And it takes some legislation. I've actually really looked into that because
yes.
we do need to be sitting there watching.
Right. And, of course, you know, Maui has this new moratorium, the miracle bill that got passed. And they have to be evaluating the health of the people who are who live near the fields where the agricultural research was going on.
But, you know, the moratorium that got thrown out, right?
Yes, I know. What there's been all this. This is what always happens with these things, is that they get. But there is still, I'm in touch with a doctor who's working on looking at health issues.
And I want to make sure Judy's still on there. Judy, are you able to hear everybody okay now?
Yes, I wasn't able to. I think you had a phone call.
Yes, and so I have fixed that now. So I'm sorry that you missed that. But so...
yeah.
A lot of her question. A lot of her question was very specific to Kauai. So, caller, thank you for calling in. The reef damage, Stephanie, do you know?
I actually do think glyphosate is playing a major role there, and in fact, my research points to that, because glyphosate disrupts the coral. I know that from what it does with manganese, which is essential for the coral to produce its shell. So I think glyphosate may be a major contributor to the coral's problems around the world, actually.
And we are having synergistic issues here, too. We have a heating of the water.
Yes.
One of the challenges that is happening is we're having less rainfall,
mm-hmm.
and then we're having more wells are pulling water out of the aquifer, so there's less fresh water coming right out onto the reef like there in Nini. And so the water's warming, so that causes
mm-hmm.
something called bleaching.
Yes.
There's been a lot of suggestion that the EMF from the Navy, the electromagnetic radiation coming out that the Navy's doing with their testing and exercises, is impacting that. And then I will say that the Prince Chorus very evidently has been killed. They have killed the graft.
Yes, I saw that. I was shocked.
Yeah, so that, and I called them, I contacted them, because there was a lot of concern over that. And they said that's standard and normal golf course procedure and in alignment with the label. So we get the same stonewall on that.
this is a lot of the problem, is that people have gotten used to these standard procedures and they've been doing them for years and they just don't see why they should stop.
And when we have maybe the Navy on their threshold, if there is any threshold that's out there for them, when we have the pumping of the water, the wells, you know, when we have all these things, when they come together synergistically, then we have a real challenge. So thank you, caller, for calling in. All right, and we have our next caller. Aloha, you are on the air. Aloha, you are on the air.
Hello, Felicia.
Yes.
Hi, it's Victoria. How are you?
Hi, Victoria. You're on with Stephanie, Judy, and myself.
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. How are you?
I'm exhausted. I worked in a garden, in a green garden all day, and talked my crew members out of using Roundup.
Great.
And using a sickle instead. A sickle is $2.98. Glyphosate is your life.
Right.
So a couple things. Standard procedure for killing that grass in Princeville, that is not standard. What is going on there is Jeff Stone, who owns all that land, has sold it to a major corporation called
partner. Morgan Stanley is out of it, and then there's a partner from, I believe, a Chinese Thai individual who's bought it.
Right, and another ghost partner called Discovery World. Have you heard about them?
Discovery Land Management, and they are the ones who are marketing the Hanalei Club.
Correct. And 230 homes from the top of Prince Course down to Anini Beach, inclusive of a couple of restaurants and a private beach club.
That's correct. Victoria, let's keep it on the science of the glyphosate, though. Yes.
Okay. So all of that killing of the grass going down to Anini, to the bleaching of the corals, is indeed part of what's happening. I believe that's part of my theory. The other thing that I think is, if we take a chain reaction from the bottom, what's happening, hurting our people, making our people sick, to the government, where is the government really controlled by? It's controlled by those five big families. And those five big families want to take over all of us. And they want us killed off, a lot of us. And that's just my theory. I might be crazy, but I believe if they keep slow poisoning us and slow poisoning our waters and slow poisoning the mamas that could be pregnant because they have too much glyphosate going on in them to produce healthy babies, they can then not generate babies. We're going to have a lot less people, and it's a slow process, but I believe there's something to that. What do you guys think?
Population control, I mean, that is a really interesting and intricate and complex topic, and I think it's hard to say. I mean, there's a temptation to believe that it's actually intentional, that to make us all sick so that and unable to reproduce, so that's one way to solve the world health
Well, one thing, when you look at the permits for the corn that was being grown here, it's no longer being grown here, but one of them was something that had a birth control in it. That was a corn that was being studied, and that was set on the permit, but I don't think it went long here.
Wow.
It just makes us have to be more green and stand up for our rights and stop producing the fuel, oil, coal, fuel things and be green. Otherwise, in another 50 years, we will have no more icebergs and no more fresh water and a whole lot less people that are healthy. And I want to stay healthy, and I want my friends who have kids to be able to grow up and be green and healthy. So it just makes us have to stand up right now, not in 10 years, but right now, against all the big corporations that are doing this, and slowly get them firstly off our island and let it grow through the states and finally be green. Thanks, Felicia.
Although, they'll do an emergency set of rules that says, oh, people are standing on the side of the road, so that's an emergency. I'm kind of joking, but that's what it feels like they've done up at Mauna Kea. So thank you so much for calling in.
Okay. Okay, have a good afternoon. Aloha.
Aloha. I would like to mention a book that I'm reading right now. I'm almost done with it, and it's outstanding. It's by Stephen Drucker, and it's called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. It's an outstanding book, very, very gripping. And he has done a really excellent job of explaining the entire GMO research and how the regulation didn't happen and all of the things that happened behind closed doors.
Say the name of that again? Altered Genes?
Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. It's an outstanding book, very readable, not too technical, and it will really make you question whether GMOs are safe or not, because it's this whole issue of doing substantial equivalence and then getting that to pass to say that the GMOs are essentially the same and therefore we don't have to test them is remarkable. And in fact, there's a new paper that just came out that showed through my field, you know, they did modeling of the effects of the gene that's changed in the plant to be able to not get poisoned by glyphosate. And if you just model that pathway, the pathways that take place with that gene broken or changed, you find out that the plant will produce too much formaldehyde and not enough glutathione. And these are actually two things that we pointed out. Anthony and I, we wrote our first paper on glyphosate. We saw from the research literature on glyphosate that these things were happening, too much formaldehyde and not enough glutathione in humans, and this is happening in humans as well. For example, that's linked to autism. Autism has those features.
Mm.
So it was very exciting to me to see this study that was done really through computer science methods that would just predict what would happen when you change those genes, because these pathways are very, very complex.
And I want to say, when people don't accept your research yet in Australia, when they can parse out these proteins and all these little pieces and
yes.
then say, okay, well, that's a good, you know...
That's computer science.
That's computer science, and that's an equivalent of deciding if there are allergies potential for this. Judy, are you still on the line?
Yes, sorry. I've had some difficulty following the conversation.
Yes.
I can hear you really well. Stephanie's quite faint.
So,
but whenever anyone phones in, I can't hear a word
yeah.
of what they're saying. So my apologies. It's not because I'm trying to be quiet.
And I'm looking at the buttons. They're all pushed the right way. But what I would like to do is allow you to have some final thoughts, and then I can let you go because I know that you're struggling to be a part of this, and we're going to have a couple other people come in. So do you have any final thoughts? We're so looking forward to seeing you, and you will certainly be meeting me.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to coming, I must say. Hawaii seems such a beautiful place to visit, so it's a great honor to be able to come to such a beautiful place and to speak to the citizens of Hawaii while I'm there. It's great. And I'd like to thank the people who've sponsored me to come over and who've organized for me to come over. I'm very, very grateful to them for doing that. Just a couple of things to wrap up. When you were talking about the computer work done to look at the allergens, that doesn't just happen in Australia. That seems to be the standard way of actually trying to determine if a GM crop's going to cause an allergy. So it sort of happens across the world with regulators that's the way they do it. The other thing, when a GM crop is safety assessed, there's essentially no assessment to see if it causes an increase in cancer because the animals aren't fed for long enough. There's also no assessment for reproductive problems. There just aren't any experiments done for that at all. And then that really leaves toxicology testing, and that is very minimally done. And in my talk, I'll describe just how woefully inadequate most of it actually is. So that there was a fairly strong probability that if a GM crop is released onto the market, with the lack of safety assessments that are done before it's released, there's a real possibility that it could actually cause harm to people. So I will be talking about that in the talks.
Well, we look very forward to having you, and thank you for taking this time and Skyping in.
And thank you very much for inviting me on your program. And what's goodbye in Hawaiian? Mahalo? No.
Mahalo is thank you. You could say ahui ho, ahui ho, until later. Ahui ho.
Well, that one. And also, thank you very much for having me on your program.
So that would be mahalo nui loa.
Thank you.
Yeah. And when you get here, before you leave, you'll be Akamai, you'll be sharp with this stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Bye. Aloha. Okay, we're going to take a caller, and then Stephanie Marshall is going to ask you a question. But this caller's been holding. Thank you so much. You're on the air. Aloha.
Hello, Felicia.
Oh, hi.
Hi, how you doing? This is Raymond Petania.
Hi.
I was going to call in.
Yes.
About there's going to be a traveling sign holding for income equality, dealing with the raising the living wage $15 an hour on Saturday. You know, when I'm talking to you, I'm getting an echo.
Yes, you, and you have you have a rough feedback. Do you have a radio on?
No, I don't have a radio on.
Okay, so let's get the key things out. Sign holding to support income equality, having a minimum wage of $15 an hour on Saturday.
Yes,
where is this?
On Saturday, we're going to be hitting four shopping centers on the island. The first one will be across Ishihara Market on the west side at 10:15. The second one will be at Kukui Grove, in front of Kukui Grove, right across the GMO fields at 11:45. The next one will be in front of Walmart at 12:30. And the next one after that will be at Safeway in Kapa'a at 1:45. All this will be on Saturday.
This coming Saturday.
This coming Saturday. It's important. You were talking about housing and income equality
last Tuesday.
The fight for wage increases is becoming a big fight, as exemplified by Bernie Sanders and other people talking about it. The front page of our paper today talked about how it's difficult to make a living here in Hawaii, in particular Kauai. So we're going to be sign holding for the living wage.
Living wage. So 10:15 in Waimea at Ishihara Market.
Across Ishihara Market.
Across,
you know, the park
in the park. So then 11:45 at Kukui Grove.
11:45 Kukui Grove.
12:30 Walmart.
In front of Kukui Grove. And 12:30 in front of Walmart. And 1:45 in front of Safeway.
In Kapa'a.
I'd like to call in a show later, you know, so I can explain a lot more of what's going on with this issue. But this Saturday, that's what's happening. If people want more information, they can call me, Raymond, at 631-6748.
631-6748. Thank you, Ray.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Wage equality and bringing up the minimum wage. Marshall. There was a caller who had a question. I know one of them was asking again the name of that book, Altered Genes, Twisted Truth.
Yes.
Stephanie, what's the author's name?
Stephen Drucker, D-R-U-K-E-R, Drucker.
Stephen Drucker. Okay, and then Marshall, what was the other question?
A caller would like to know, what are the foods that are genetically engineered?
Oh, that's a good question. Definitely should.
Are they the same for humans and animals? Which ones are for which?
Yeah, there's only actually a few that have been engineered to be resistant to Roundup, which is, of course, the thing I'm interested in. And there's just the BT corn, which Judy mentioned. That's the insecticide built into the plant. The one
BT
corn. Mm-hmm. And then so the Roundup Ready crops are the corn, the soy, canola, sugar beets, alfalfa, and cotton.
Okay, and then so those foods actually end up in so many different things.
Yes.
Because corn gets separated and is everything from high fructose corn syrup to xanthan gum to all these little fine print things on the ingredient label. And then soybeans go into many things, in oil, canola oil. So a lot of times it's just in the oils.
The oils are really bad. I mean, I think if you're going to have a short list of things to buy organic, and if you're going to choose to use canola oil or soybean oil, you have to buy it organic. I don't eat them. I don't use them at all, personally.
And what I've noticed is because there's a high demand for organics now, they'll use words like original, and they'll write it in a way where it looks
way. It looks like it might be, yes.
Or it'll say made with...
Natural.
Natural. It'll say made with organic blue corn, but you look and then the oil...
Yes.
It isn't. And so it's the one rule of thumb that I use with myself is if it looks like something like a chayote or a potato or an onion or something with one ingredient,
mm-hmm.
it's the whole food.
Right.
That's a pretty safe way for going at it. You know, it doesn't mean it's raised organic, but it's like if you buy organic vegetables. In my case, I'm getting more and more out of my yard, and a lot of my food comes from what just is grown in my yard, and it doesn't cost me anything because I have plants that produce a lot and grow like a bad weed because I don't like to weed, water, or work. So
yeah, that's really great, and I think this is a place where people can grow some of their own food, and I think this whole concept of victory gardens that they had during the war is appropriate right now for people to take ownership of their food by growing their own and growing it organically.
I'm going to have you and your husband over for dinner, and it's going to be intimidating because mm-hmm. he is an incredible cook. I can't say that for me, but you're going to have...
He will really appreciate. We will both appreciate organic. That's just wonderful.
Yes, it'll be that. And then I have another friend who is in the studio right now, Joan Porter. Let me make sure you're mic'd up.
It's great to be here. It's really great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And you have done so much. I would say you have worked tirelessly to raise awareness for healthy eating in so many ways. You are perhaps very outstanding in our community for your quiet but effective efforts to be making a big difference. And I have this beautiful little card for film in my hand called Ina.
Mm.
And is your hand in that too?
Yes. excuse me. We actually started producing this film. It's a 22-minute film.
Oh.
We actually started producing it about a year and a half ago when we were working strongly on the charter amendment to help the chemical companies do have a different behavior.
Okay, okay.
And so the film was to be a part of that, to help bring awareness for people to vote for it, because we had hoped it would be on
the
ballot in November, which it did not happen. So we ended up with this film and said, okay, what are we going to do now? And we have toned it down a bit, and because one of the things that happened for me when we were unable to have the amendment put on the ballot.
And tell us what the amendment was for. It was a charter amendment regarding...
It was a charter amendment regarding having the chemical companies contain what they're spraying and what they were doing with
their
GMO.
They had basically get a permit, and to get that permit, they needed to be able to prove that it wasn't going beyond their boundaries.
That's right.
They could do whatever they wanted on their land. They just had to prove that it wasn't blowing down wind or going downstream or migrating, correct?
That's correct.
And that was basically frustrated off the ballot for a variety of reasons.
Yes, that's right.
So just kind of getting...
That's in the past.
That's the short version of it. So this film is called Ina.
So this film is called Ina, That Which Feeds Us. And it's a beautiful film, particularly beautiful about Kauai. And it also is encouraging and inspiring for each of us to really start thinking and to wake up about what we're doing with our food and to think about eating organically and to pay attention to some of the research like Stephanie and Judy are doing. It is a big problem in our world. And thank you, Stephanie, for your work. And thanks to Judy, although I don't think she's on the phone now.
She's probably still listening, though, Judy. How you mate, right? And I got to figure out their way of saying things. So it's going to be at the Kauai Performing Arts Center, July 25th at 7 p.m.
That's right. The doors will open at 6, and it's at 7 p.m. And if you are interested in a ticket, I invite you to go to Ina, A-I-N-I, dot Eventbrite, Eventbrite .com.
And you can't say the price, but it's not a lot. So it's a 22-minute film. I'm guessing if people drive all the way down there, they're going to see more than just this 22-minute film.
That's right. That's right. The folks who are in the film will also be in the house. And
oh, you've got a pretty amazing cast in there.
A very amazing cast.
And for people who have lived here for generations, you'll be happy with the cast.
That's right. Absolutely. And so they will be in the house and will be speaking just briefly. And then the WIPA, I'm not sure of their correct name, but the WIPA
Foundation?
No, the singers, the WIPA.
Oh, the WIPA singers, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, and players. I apologize for not knowing their accurate name, but they also will be performing for us. So it will be a wonderful evening and lots of aloha and a beautiful, beautiful film.
So the WIPA players will be singing, but will they be talking? Like I see Uncle David Sprout and different people like that in there. Are they going to, or is anybody going to be speaking to the community? Are there going to be pieces where they get information?
There will be speakers. Everybody who's in the film, I think there's about seven different people who are in the film, and they will be speaking just briefly, each of them, that evening. So... I hesitate to start saying the names because I'm afraid I'll leave somebody out because I don't have them.
Well, there's a trailer out there on the air, I mean on the web, and if people could go to www.inafeeds, A-I-N-A, feeds, F-E-E-D-S dot U-S, and they can see the trailer there.
Yes, and one of the really important things about this is to get the word out. So the day after the performance on the 25th, so on the 26th, we'll have a thunderclap. And what that means is at 6 p.m. on the 26th, thousands of emails and Facebook pages will go off, and hopefully this travels far and wide around the planet.
So do you have a distribution effort or idea for it? I'm assuming it will be online for free once it's...
Yes, it will be. It will be. And so if you go to the website, there will be information about that. And also there will be given, the night of the performance will give directions in how to do that.
And I have a question. I'm looking at this beautiful image, and it's the Earth with... green fuzzy plants on it, but to me when I look at it, it's not the continents and stuff like that that I recognize. Is there a meaning behind that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I haven't talked to Josh, who was the artist, and he's also the director of the film, about why that was done, but my guess is that when you do something international, that you want to have something that everybody can identify with. In other words, if we showed Africa and people in North America and South America and say, well, what, they didn't show us on the Earth, and vice versa. So I think it's an artist's choice to put forth something that's beautiful that we all identify with, but nobody feels left out.
Okay, and in recognition of Judy being from South Australia, I really enjoy down there how the maps are very often putting south in the upward position, so gravity is on the side of South America and Australia. We have Jazz with John coming up in a little less than 15 minutes. Marshall, you just look like you have something to say.
I'm just picturing those Aussies standing on their heads.
We're down on the low end of the planet. We get to be down under. Joan, do you have any thoughts on what you have heard from both Stephanie and Judy?
You know, I was listening closely, and I'm so grateful for the research that you're doing. It's really important, and the information has to get out to people. You know, we're so divided and we're so singular, and it's a time in our evolution that we have to come together. So you know, keep up the good work. And And I also have to say, I know as a human being how easy it is to say, well, this isn't going to matter that much. And so we kind of go to sleep. And I'm always looking at ways, how do we help people to get a sense of what will make their life better when it takes a long time for it to go awry.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just add that I don't have the answer. I mean, my answer these days is love. It's the only thing that will create change and sometimes miracles. And, you know, we have to be nice to each other and to ourselves.
We have to be nice to each other, and we just can't give up.
That's right.
I think that that's the big thing. And I know when I went to this Board and Land and Natural Resources meeting last week, it's intense because it is so expensive to fly over there, and there really weren't very many people from Kauai at this particular meeting. It was like Oahu really showed up. There was a little bit of Maui, two of us that I saw from Kauai, and then, you know, a few from Hawaii. But there was some really excellent testimony that is hard to see how they can just turn such a cold heart to, like even people who are in the enforcement saying, hey, these people are being so kind and loving. You know, they're amplifying whatever little dark story that they could find. And then there was an English professor from UH who had a really important story to bring forward with photographs, which is the water. There's a lake up there, and where they're actually draining these natural aquifers and taking them down to Pahakuloa. And they really are having an impact, and I looked at the environmental impact statement that was put out by the TMT. And, for example, they have a 5,000-gallon storage tank right in there for the toxic chemicals.
Mm.
And that's right at the top of the aquifer. And what we've seen with Red Hill on Oahu, I don't know if you followed this, Stephanie, but there is... The military stores all their chemicals, and mostly petrochemicals, oil and fuel, over there on Oahu. And recently, I don't have the information right in front of me, but it was like 27,000 gallons spill went into the aquifer. Mm. But then as they've looked at it, it's been over 2 million gallons of fuel spilled into that water aquifer, which feeds 25% of Oahu.
Wow.
And that, to me, is where you need emergency procedures. That, to me, is where maybe there are crimes or something really needing action. And it's been in the press, but they basically, you know, have something like, don't worry about it, it's contained, but how are we going to get it out of there, right? And so it's... I work to stay positive. I do feel positive. It makes me feel positive that there are so many people who are speaking out, like you, Stephanie, or Judy, or Joan, what you've done. Marshall does all kinds of solution-building ideas that I really appreciate. But I want to give a shout-out to all the people who are out there who are activated. And for people who work within these companies and within these organizations that are still trying to do righteous elements. We're going to have the county council report in a few moments. I appreciate that our John Gordon from Jazz with John records this. Tomorrow there are a number of elements that I think are worthy of discussing. Ross Kadawa is introducing something to reverse a recent ruling that got placed in there for county council people to have term limits. They were supposed to do 4 terms and then they need to time out. That was a lot of work was put into that, asking for that to happen. And when people want charter amendments and they look to put a charter amendment on the ballot as opposed to making a rule, sometimes that happens because they don't want it just immediately overturned. And so that's one that looks, you know, it's going to need a little bit of voicing on tomorrow. What I am really happy to hear about, I think it's Mel Raposo, is bringing out, starting a discussion on how to help the chronically houseless. That's something that we really need to be looking at. As I mentioned earlier, I just happened to notice on... They bring in different meeting minutes. There was something from the Planning Commission, and I got to really study what that is in Kekaha. A lot of elements there, things that have to do with the old government roads And we need to make sure that those old government roads, which are sometimes a last option for people to be able to hold on to their access from point A to point B. It's not clear whether it's state or county. We need to make sure that when those are going to be placed or moved or put in different positions, because they can be just almost assigned away or sold away, and it can happen quietly, that we're paying attention. So that's on there tomorrow. Though very often those meeting minutes still just say, that's item 190, 2015-190. They'll say the minute meetings from the Planning Commission in April. All those in favor, aye. All those opposed, it moves on to the next piece. It takes a lot of diligence to be sitting there looking after that, not just from us, but certainly from the people who are doing that job, the county council. All these jobs actually take an incredible amount of fine attention to detail. And so I'm doing a shout out to Kekaha, Waimea, this is your area, not mine, you know, to maybe be paying attention if there is roads out there that you want to make sure you have continued access. One of them looked like to me it goes up to Waiava Valley. People in Kekaha, do your homework tomorrow. So any final thoughts, Marshall?
I'm just real grateful for Stephanie and Joan and Judy, especially. Thank you so much for your patience, and what a great show, Felicia.
Thank you. Thank you to you guys for coming
in. Thank you for doing it. It's really great. It's always great to be back here.
Thank you. So July 28th, 29th, 30th.
That's right.
Waimea, Princeville, Lihue, or Puhi. All right. Joan, final thoughts?
Just thank you so much. Thanks for what you're doing, Felicia. Thanks, Marshall. Thanks, KKCR.
Yes.
And thank you, Stephanie and Judy.
Your event, July 25th. And then there's a double event on your night, the 29th. We also have some folks putting an event out at the Niumalu Canoe Club on weather modification or climate change. We always have a little bit of a struggle on how to say that. Not sure if the world is warming up or cooling down, but something seems to be happening. And if there's something we can do about it to help it stay as healthy as possible, that'd be great. So this is Felicia with Kauai's Soapbox saying thank you for listening and aloha.
Aloha, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Here's the County Council report for the week of July 13th. There will be a regular council meeting Wednesday at 8:30 a.m. in the council chambers in Lihue. Here's some highlights from the agenda. Council Chair Raposo transmits for consideration a resolution requesting the State of Hawaii rename Kapuli Highway as the Kauai Veterans Memorial Kapuli Highway. See resolution number 2015-51. The Director of Planning transmits the Planning Commission's recommendation to amend the county code to allow farm worker housing permits to be issued to farmers whose condominium property regime declarations have been amended after August 16, 2010. This is proposed draft bill number 2459. Council Vice Chair Kagawa transmits for council consideration a resolution proposing a charter amendment relating to term limits for council members. See resolution number 2015-52. Council Chair Raposo requests the Managing Director discuss the administration's efforts to address the issue of homelessness on Kauai. There are two claims against the county this week, one for vehicle damage and the other for violation of civil rights. Under committee reports, the Public Safety Committee approved Bill 2598 relating to the recovery of rescue expenses, and this is also under bills for the second reading. The Committee of the Whole received a request for the record from the Council Chair for the Managing Director, the Office of the County Auditor, and the County's External Audit Consultant to discuss the audit of county hiring practices and the audit of the county payroll system. Bills for the first reading include proposed draft bill 2498 for an ordinance to amend the county code relating to bus stops for commercial development. Kauai County Council is the applicant, and this was referred to the Planning Commission on August 28, 2013. There will be a non-public executive session. The purpose is to consult with the council's legal counsel relating to obtaining approval of a proposed settlement of a workers' compensation claim, and also the Office of the County Attorney on behalf of the council requests the executive session to provide the council with a briefing regarding the claim against the county by Advantage Rent-A-Car for damage to their vehicle. If the council is not finished with this meeting by approximately 1:30 p.m., it will recess for a public hearing on Bill 2590 for an ordinance to amend the county code by repealing Article 25 relating to barking dogs. After the public hearing, the council will reconvene to complete any unfinished business. For more information, visit the county's website at www.kauai.gov. The council does have links to quite a few of the documents on the agenda on their website. Until next week, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Aloha. And you are listening to KKCR Honolulu, KAQA Kilauea. Stay tuned for Jazz with John coming up next. Great show, Felicia. Always interesting. Always very, very informative. And I want to let you know that Jazz with John is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the Kauai Coffee Company, Kamoa Ukulele, and Tiki Aniki.
Kauai Coffee, 100% pure Hawaiian, single-origin, GMO-free coffee. Grown and roasted here on the Garden Island, at retail locations island-wide on all the Hawaiian Islands, and at our estate on Highway 540 between Kalaheo and Ali'ali, where walking tours and coffee tasting are also available. More information and ordering online at kauaicoffee.com.
Kamoa Ukulele Company, dedicated to building high-quality bell-tone instruments, built with a one-player-at-a-time philosophy, from student models up to custom masterpieces. Kamoa Ukulele Company, a family-owned business, supports KKCR. 652-9999 or online at kamoaukulelecompany.com.